You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin expert on kids and concussions shares some of the latest research on recovery and how much rest is too much.
First, we're taking a look at a new report that looks at how people, especially kids, are segregated from different economic groups. The report, called Fault Lines, looked at the child poverty rates of students on either side of a school district boundary and how much they differed.
The more stark the difference in childhood poverty from one side of that school district border to another, the more segregating the border is considered. And a Wisconsin school district boundary was in the top 50.
Joining us now to tell us more is Rebecca Sebelia. She's the founder and CEO of EdBuild, the organization that released the report. EdBuild is a nonprofit that says its mission is to bring common sense and fairness to the way states fund schools. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
So where in Wisconsin are we seeing school district borders that cause segregation?
They are all, unfortunately, surrounding Milwaukee. So in terms of kind of the borders around Milwaukee, there are 15 total neighbors. And of that, three of the neighbors actually rank in the top 50 of the most segregating in the country.
Give us a sense of how many school districts you looked at total.
So we looked at 33,500 school district lines, and we built an algorithm that basically compared child poverty across each one of those lines, so consistently comparing neighbors.
Now, Milwaukee is Wisconsin's biggest city. Compared to what you've seen elsewhere in the country, is it fair to say that this is an urban problem, or is it not that simple?
It's not that simple. We really see three problems associated with how these segregating borders come to exist. The first is that we have a reliance on property taxes that exacerbates income segregation. That's just how schools are funded, and so we see purposefully gerrymandered borders. We have legal precedent, both at the Supreme Court level and at the state level, that allows these borders to exist and makes it nearly impossible to desegregate across them. And the third is that school finance systems just haven't kept up with changing demographics. That's certainly true for the cities that we're seeing in the Rust Belt particularly. And so while it is an urban problem, it's kind of compounded by changing demographics as well.
Well, let's talk about those boundaries that showed up in your worst 50 list. What are you seeing when you look at Milwaukee?
So when we look at Milwaukee, we see something that's very similar to what we're seeing in other traditionally Rust Belt cities. So we see a deepening of poverty as the kind of population shrinks, and we're certainly seeing growth in the neighborhood suburbs that directly surround the city. When we look at kind of the overall, demographics of those neighbors, in some cases, we're looking at the difference of median household income of upwards of $100,000 in some of the neighbors versus about $35,000 in Milwaukee. So we see a dividing kind of a growing chasm between the haves and have-nots.
And in this case, you focused on the economics of this, not looking at other factors such as race. Why focus on the economics?
Well, we're a school funding organization, and we really focus on how the way that states fund schools contributes to segregation. And because of that, we focused on income, because school funding is so directly tied to both property wealth and the ability of families to pay those taxes. Income segregation means a whole lot more in terms of getting to the root of that specific problem, which is what is the role of the school finance system.
What is the effect that you saw? What happens when a school district boundary falls on the disadvantaged side of an affluent area?
What that means is that there's less property tax income per student that can be directed to to the schools. And so whereas some of Milwaukee's neighbors are generating upwards of $9,000 per pupil from their property taxes, Milwaukee is only unfortunately able to generate about $3,600. That's a pretty large gulf that has to be filled by the state in order to equalize for that revenue. When you have low-income districts, not just in Milwaukee but across the country, who become reliant on the state in order to fund their schools, you open them up to just more political turmoil, and you certainly don't want that to be applied to the neediest children.
We're talking with Rebecca Sebilia right now. She's the founder and CEO of EdBuild, a nonprofit that looks at school funding. And she's talking with us right now about segregating school district borders in Milwaukee. And zooming out now from Milwaukee, what did you see when you looked at the rest of the country?
One of the kind of overwhelming findings was that almost all of the segregation that we found to be the worst was located mostly in the Northeast and the Rust Belt. That was actually surprising to us, and one of the things that we started to dig into was actually looking at the policies of how school district borders could come to be in the first place. What's actually surprising is that in the South, school district borders are largely tied to county lines. So either they run along county lines or they're drawn within county lines, but that existing municipality is the basis for how school district borders are drawn. That is certainly not the case in kind of the Rust Belt states in the Northeast, where school district boundaries are not drawn along existing municipal lines. What that does is it creates the ability to intentionally segregate in order to kind of keep high-wealth areas and high-wealth neighborhoods funding for, you know, just their schools.
Now, when you think about the Rust Belt and the Rust Belt economy, you think about manufacturing and a loss of manufacturing jobs. Does that have a role to play in this?
We believe it absolutely has. One of the pieces that we're actually going to put out next week is a spotlight on what's happened in some of the Rust Belt cities. What we've seen is basically an emptying of the city when industry left, and the resulting kind of flight of the middle class left that city under-enrolled and more impoverished. And because we don't go back and look at school district borders on a regular basis, what we're not doing is kind of changing those lines based on shifts in demographics. And so what you end up with are pockets of dense poverty where prosperity used to exist.
Now, one of the things you talk about in your report is that this is maybe not something that's easily fixable by redrawing district lines because of a Supreme Court decision. Can you tell us where we stand with that?
So the decision was Milliken v. Bradley. It was actually a case that was brought in Detroit and its surrounding neighbors. And in that Supreme Court case, they ruled that desegregation did not have to occur across school district boundaries. They basically cemented the school district boundary as a means of purposefully segregating. We believe that there has to be a meaningful challenge to this specific court case in order to bring about the real change that we need, which is not allowing school district borders to be drawn into, you know, discriminately. Short of that, there are other things that legislatures can do to fix this problem. We can look at larger tax bases that still allow for local control of schools, but a broadening of kind of the economics of the school districts in the region. We can certainly look at what we touched on earlier, which is kind of a mandated review of whether or not school district boundaries are working with changing demographics every 5 to 10 years. If we do that for our electoral system, there's no reason why we can't do that for our school districts.
Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us today.
It was wonderful to be here. Thanks for having me.
That was Rebecca Sebilia, the founder and CEO of EdBuild. She talked to us about a report that looks at lines segregating school district borders in Milwaukee and beyond. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin has made a lot of progress in attracting and retaining doctors, but a new report says while the state has made some big strides, it still could face a physician shortage. We'll learn more coming up.
First, as the back-to-school season gets closer, newly published research from UW-Madison tries to get answers to questions about concussions and kids. Specifically, when can kids get back into mental activities like schoolwork after recovering from a concussion?
Dr. Danny Thomas joins us now. He's a pediatric emergency medicine physician at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and an associate professor of pediatric emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin. His new research was published in the journal JAMA Pediatrics. Dr. Thomas, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
Well, before we get to the findings in this new research you worked on, what kind of questions were you trying to answer in this research on concussions and recovery?
Well, in the past, management has really been centered around the idea that activity after concussion could make your symptoms worse. And so we were looking at some research we had conducted in a secondary analysis, and we're trying to answer the question, whether activity did worsen symptoms by looking at something we call symptom spikes. And symptom spikes are defined as an increase in symptoms from one day to another. And we thought, well, we'd look at this data set, see where patients had symptom spikes, and look what was their activity level the day prior to their symptom spike. And that is what sort of motivated the research. What we found was that symptom spikes are actually pretty common in the early recovery period in that first 10 days. About 1 in 3 patients are going to have a symptom spike. The majority of those symptom spikes aren't really associated with an increase in physical activity or mild increases in mental activity. But we did find that with high intensity mental activities like returning to school, doing homework, did increase the risk of having a symptom spike. So your symptoms are going to get a little bit worse if you go back to school. But the good news is most of those symptom spikes resolve within 24 hours, and the kids had a normal recovery at 10 days.
Yeah, a lot of people might think, okay, we've got to steer clear. We've got to think about physical activity and maybe not think about that mental activity. The brain is doing a lot of work when it goes back to school.
Absolutely. And I think that both physical and mental activity are really important things to be monitoring after concussion. But what we're finding is that over-restriction has a downside, as well as just a blanket letting them return back to full contact sports and things. So we have to find that sweet spot where kids will actually use their brain, engage their body in physical exercise, which is really helpful for the brain in recovery, but also not put themselves at increased risk or overstressing their system.
Right. I want to key in on that one side of that fine line, the idea that too much rest can be a bad thing. Because I would think as a parent, oh, I'm going to err on the side of caution, restrict that physical activity, restrict that mental activity. That, and this fits with some other research you've done on rest and concussions, that can actually be the opposite of helpful.
Yeah, I think so. So some research we conducted that was the data set for this secondary analysis showed that we did a randomized trial, which means that folks came into the emergency department immediately after their concussion. We flipped a coin and decided whether we would tell them to either rest for 5 days, meaning stay at home, don't go to school, versus resting for 1 or 2 days, which is really what our standard approach is now. And we found that the folks that were told to rest for 5 days reported a lot more symptoms during those 5 days, and took a full 4 days to fully recover. So it just delayed their recovery and actually made them feel worse. Though it might be that they were just sitting at home, perseverating on their symptoms.
You got nothing else to think about except those symptoms.
Yeah, and so I think the way I would describe it, it's like a toothache. You know, if you're you know, at nighttime, your tooth that's when the toothache bothers you the worst, when there's no other distractions through the day. But, you know, you have the same, you know, cavity in the morning and the night. It's just that at night, when there's no distractions, that's when you're going to notice those symptoms.
What I would worry about is, okay, it's been a couple few days since the initial injury. Send the kid back to school. And then, as you say, there can be these symptom spikes. My gut reaction then as a parent or probably a teacher of the kid is, uh-oh, too soon, we shouldn't have sent them back. But it sounds like what you're saying is even with those symptoms recurring, that's not necessarily leading to a bad outcome.
Absolutely. And I think that's actually what I think this current paper is the most helpful in doing is, you know, when that family calls the doctor and says, my kid's symptoms got worse after that first day back, the doctors can say, you know what, this is pretty common. It happens to about 1 in 3 patients, and they get better with time, and it really shouldn't affect your overall recovery. Certainly, you know, it really is depends on what we're talking about when it comes to those symptoms. When we're looking at our symptom spikes, they're an increase in symptoms, but we're not talking about severe migraine where a kid is vomiting and can't really be in school. We're talking about a mild increase in symptoms. So I think it's just informs us all that to not consider that a setback, but to consider that sort of normal. It's pretty normal for that to happen, and it's not necessarily something to worry about.
Talking to Dr. Danny Thomas about recent research he's done on concussions and recovery. And Dr. Thomas, I want to do a little bit of a timeline with you, if I may, to see when a kid should be resting after the concussion, when they can start segueing back in. So after that initial injury, a suspected concussion on the playground, on the sports field, whatever, what are the first steps a parent or a coach should take?
Sure. So I think the first thing we have to do is we have to make sure that we don't think the child has a more significant injury than a concussion. Concussion is a mild traumatic brain injury, but that's the bottom of the spectrum. The top of the spectrum is that severe head injury, severe brain injury, and brain bleeding. And those accidents, I'm an ER physician, so I know those things can happen in the playground, they can happen on the sports field, they can happen anywhere. So really those first few minutes, seconds, and hours after a head injury, we really want to assess the child, and if they're acting pretty normally, they're not having vomiting, they're not, they didn't lose consciousness, they don't have prolonged amnesia, they probably are going to be okay. Continuing to monitor them in those first few minutes and hours, as long as their symptoms are getting progressively better, they're probably okay with those minor mechanisms. But the next thing you want to do, those first 1 or 2 days, we'd recommend rest. That's still a reasonable thing to do in the first 24 to 48 hours after injury. The body actually is going to want to rest. Most kids get kind of, it's pretty universal after a head injury to get kind of sleepy, and that's actually, there's nothing wrong with that. It's totally reasonable to rest and sleep. It's a way for the brain to recharge and get better. After that first 24 to 48 hours, I think the focus really should be on getting back to those activities of daily life. So getting back to normal activities, walks around your house, walks around the block, the normal things that you do to sort of take care of yourself are the things that we'd encourage kids to do. Then we'd look at getting them back to school because that's their job. They should be in school and learning as much as they can. And sometimes we might need to have some accommodations to do that, maybe some extra time for classroom work, maybe some rest breaks in class. Schools are now more familiar with how to manage concussions, and certainly your physician could give them some guidance as well. And once they're tolerating school and tolerating some light physical activity, if they're in a sport, there's something we call the stepwise return to play, which is a very structured sort of return increase in exercise and exposure to contact and head impacts until you're ready to be cleared to participate in competition.
Because that has been a big worry lately, not so much that first head injury, but the second one before recovery is complete.
Correct. And we are all definitely worried about folks who have a head injury and then re-injure themselves before they're fully recovered. And really that for kids, for whatever reason, represents a significant risk of vulnerability in kids. So there's something, it's pretty rare, but it's something called second impact syndrome, where somebody has a head injury and then a relatively minor second head injury before they've recovered and they have brain swelling and severe brain injury from that. It's very rare, and we don't know exactly why it happens to some people, but we do know that the risk factor is having a recent head injury and not fully recovering. On the other side, we know that folks who have a head injury and fully recover and can get back, go through that stepwise return to play under the guidance of a physician, they do fine, and their brain is back to the way it was before the injury, and they tend to do fine. And you know, the we worry about the kids who are having concussions, but we also worry a lot more about the kids who are having concussions back to back, having concussions with less force. So the second concussion required a lot less force to occur. That's telling us that the brain is maybe not fully recovered, even recovering. So I think those are red flags that a kid might need to be evaluated by a concussion specialist before getting cleared to continue to participate in collision sports.
You talked earlier about a normal recovery from a suspected concussion, you know, that serious rest for the first day or maybe two, and then gradually reintroducing activities. What kind of things should we watch out for that it isn't a normal recovery, that we should be giving a doctor a call?
Yeah, so I mean, the main thing is that, you know, concussion has about four different sort of categories of symptoms. So we have physical symptoms like headache and nausea, dizziness and balance problems. You have cognitive symptoms like feeling foggy or thinking slowly, having difficulty remembering. You have emotional symptoms like being irritable or crabby or feeling depressed or sad. And then there's sleep-related symptoms. Some kids have insomnia. Some kids are sleeping excessively. Or sort of like just tons of fatigue. The ones that we tend to want you to call your physician about are those physical symptoms. So if your child is having a severe and progressive headache, severe and progressive vomiting, if they're having trouble even staying awake, they're so lethargic, those are all red flags for something that is worse. But generally speaking, small increases in those little, like a mild increase in your headache, a mild increase in your nausea, not necessarily considered a significant setback, and is probably part of the normal recovery pattern for most folks.
So maybe the message to parents like me is maybe don't panic quite so much for
right.
that minor concussion.
I think the truth of the matter is concussion has been around longer than, you know, has been around for a really long time. I think we're learning a lot more about it. But, you know, I'm sure if you talk to your grandparents about concussion, they probably think about a lot of this is a hoopla or whatnot, because, you know, and back in their day, folks did fine. And I think kids are going to continue to do fine. We're a lot more aware of the symptoms, but that awareness doesn't necessarily change their recovery. We just need to be the real thing. The truth is that we have to be safe about that re-injury and that re-entry to the sports, which, you know, are great. Because the other issue is that when we have a childhood obesity problem, and we want our kids to be active, so we got to find that fine line where we get them out there so they're enjoying the environment, doing fun things, getting their heart rate up, but not and then when they inevitably are going to get injured, because that's life, we have to manage that appropriately so they're safe.
Dr. Thomas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. It was wonderful.
That was Dr. Danny Thomas, pediatric emergency medicine physician at Children's Hospital of Wisconsin and associate professor of pediatric emergency medicine at the Medical College of Wisconsin, talking about some of his latest research on concussions and recovery for kids.
Coming up, Wisconsin could face a shortage of doctors in the coming decades. We'll learn more after the news. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Latino USA. In the wake of the Olympics, Latino USA takes a look at topics related to Brazilians and Brazilian Americans. That's coming up tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, a new report published by the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce shows that Wisconsin could have a shortage of nearly 4,000 doctors by the year 2035.
And according to that report, demand for doctors in the state could jump by 25% over the next two decades.
Joining us now to talk about the expected doctor shortage is George Quinn. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. George, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, let's start. This is obviously a supply and demand issue. We'll get into some of the things that are being done about it, but I want to start on the demand side. Where do we see an increased demand for doctors in Wisconsin coming from?
Well, it comes from both the growth in overall population in Wisconsin, projected to increase by 12% over the next 20 years, but more importantly, by the increase of the over 65 population, which is expected to increase 69%. Folks that are 65 and over tend to place much more demand on health care, about 3.5 times as much as the overall average.
And this is a problem, I imagine, as the baby boomer population ages around the country. Wisconsin's probably not alone in this, but are we, as demographic trends go, a particularly aging state?
We are. We're probably in the upper half in that regard. And I think there are other states that would not necessarily be in the same situation 20 years from now. Florida is a good example of that. But in terms of the upper Midwest, Wisconsin's fairly typical.
And on the supply side, do we see not enough doctors being trained now to have them online and ready to rock in 20 years?
Yes, I think that's the multifactored problem there. Number one, while the over 65 population in Wisconsin's projected increase by the amount we indicated, the working age population, the 18 to 64, is expected to decrease by 1%. So we have a very much of a mismatch here in terms of supply and demand. Secondly, we produce out of our medical schools and residency programs a number of physicians every year, but in no way at its current rate will keep up with what we need.
And of course, if the population as a whole aging, those doctors are part of that population. I imagine we're going to see a lot of those doctors aging, retiring out of the system and being just patients instead of being patients and doctors themselves.
That's true, although Wisconsin has a lower than average age in its physician workforce. So we do benefit from that. We're in one of the lower quartiles there in that regard.
So that's 20 years from now. Let's look at 2016 for a moment. How do we stack up now when it comes to the number of doctors out there versus the number of patients and hours they need to serve those patients?
Well, right now we're at a fairly good median point. There are anecdotal stories about shortages. The state of Wisconsin, however, does currently calculate an amount of shortages, but they tend to be isolated. In rural areas in particular, northern parts of the state, inner city parts of Milwaukee, for example.
Another wrinkle that's there in your report, we hear a lot of calls for better patient service by allowing doctors to spend more time with each patient that they meet. Obviously, if that's a goal of ours, that's going to put more stress on this doctor shortage in 20 years.
I think one of the strategies is likely to be more use of team-based care, where you instead of having a physician meeting for the entire time of that visit, more other practitioners such as the physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, and so forth, so that we can better leverage physician resources.
We're talking to George Quinn. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce, looking at a projected shortfall of doctors in Wisconsin, especially in about 20 years. And George, I hit the word projected hard there. I know your organization and others are working on this now to try to make it so that we're not in that position. What kind of things are already happening in Wisconsin to try to deal with this projected shortfall?
Well, there are at least two positive developments in that regard. The first has to do with a relatively new state program, which provides grants to those organizations that wish to either start or expand graduate medical education. That's the period of training after graduation from medical school. And the reason that was taken as a strategy was that GME provides the best bang for the buck, if you will. Number one, there's a higher retention rate among GME graduates than from our own medical schools. About a third of graduates from our medical schools stay in practice in Wisconsin. About 50% from the graduate medical education program stay in practice, number one. So the retention issue is a very important one. Secondly, these programs can be started and implemented within, a three-year period at relatively low cost. So that's why we suggested that there be a grant program put into the state budget, and it's currently in the state budget. And that has some very positive results. 11 organizations have been granted money to either start or expand new GME programs. And up to this point, it will result in 73 new positions, every year 73 physicians being trained in these programs, graduating about 21 per year. So that's a positive development.
So you mentioned graduates of Wisconsin medical schools, only about a third of them end up staying in this state. Apart from this idea of graduate medical education, GME, that's what that stood for. What other ideas are there to try to keep more of those Wisconsin-trained doctors serving in Wisconsin?
Well, another very positive development was the Medical College of Wisconsin opening two new campuses, one in Green Bay and one in Wausau. The idea is from the kind of grow-your-own philosophy. The more likely that you are able to attract, let's say, college graduates into your medical school from that same state, the more likely you are to then have a retention, a higher retention rate. As a matter of fact, our statistics show that if you graduated from a medical school in Wisconsin and from a GME program in Wisconsin, there's a 70% retention rate. But that goes even further if that same student had graduated from a college or university in Wisconsin, that reaches 86%, pretty high rate. So that development has been very positive. Their first few classes that they have admitted have a very high percentage of students from Wisconsin, about 85 to 90%.
Do we have enough students, say, at the high school level in Wisconsin, wanting to go into medicine, or do we need to step up our efforts to recruit more high schoolers into medical school?
And it really needs to start right around that time, maybe even in middle school. And we have the Wisconsin AHEC program, the Area Health Education Councils, do a good job in that regard, but we need to step up that effort.
Are we at a place where we need incentives, apart from educating students here, incentives to stay and work in Wisconsin, maybe especially in areas where we're already seeing maybe problems recruiting general practitioners, specialists in rural or big city Wisconsin?
Well, I think that could come. I think right now our focus has been on making sure that we have enough graduate medical education slots, number one, and number two, that we're directing our attention towards Wisconsin-oriented folks, people who have some background in Wisconsin.
We sometimes hear about recruiting people from around the world to come to medical schools here and to practice medicine in the country. It sounds like that's not your starting point for meeting this gap.
That's not our priority at this point because we continue to fall back on our retention statistics and rely on those. And I think those have proven to be a very effective way to increase our workforce.
How about specializations? Do we expect to have a shortage in particular types of medicine?
Well, the areas that we've focused on are primary care, in other words, family medicine, for example, general surgery, those surgeons who do general type work, not the orthopedic surgeons and so forth, and psychiatry. Those are areas of particular need. Our grant program, the one that we were able to implement through the state budget, requires grantees to have to form or expand residency programs in those three specialties. They also need to have a fairly substantial component of the training take place in rural areas. So primary care, general surgery, psychiatry, and in rural areas. And that has proven to be very successful.
We're talking to George Quinn. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. He's joining us to talk about an expected doctor shortage coming up here in Wisconsin.
And we'd like to hear from you. Are you a doctor who's concerned about caring for patients in the event of a physician shortage? How do you think the state should reach out to prospective doctors? Or if you're a Wisconsin resident, what do you think about a potential pending doctor shortage? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your thoughts to talk@wpr.org.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you in just a bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about a potential shortage of doctors in Wisconsin in the next couple of decades, according to a new report published this week. And we want to hear from you. Are you a Wisconsin resident who's worried about a potential doctor shortage, or are you a physician who's facing this themselves? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
And if you're on the front lines of this, if you work in healthcare, in a hospital, or in medical education, we'd love to hear your perspective, too, at 800-642-1234. George Quinn is with us. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. That's the group that published this new study. George, before we go to our callers, talk about the worst case. We don't do enough to meet this. What does healthcare look like in Wisconsin in 20 years?
Well, I think we'd be facing, since we would have a gap, we would be facing issues relating to access and how will that population in the year 2035 gain access to providers that it needs? Those are unanswered questions at this point.
We'll bring on our callers now. Tom is with us in Waukegan, Iowa. Tom, hi.
Hi. Your expert talked about retention rates, but didn't talk about some of the reasons for the lower retention rates. And I'm wondering how welcome foreign, out-of-the-country trained medical staff really are here with the politics the way they are. My guess is that the retention rates there are not very high. I have some experience in seeing people leave I thought would stay.
Tom, thanks for the call. George, I don't know if your statistics go down this fine, but do we know whether foreign-born medical providers are staying here? Are we retaining them as well as anyone else?
No, I think we have the same experience as other states. Those retention rates tend to be lower, as you might imagine, folks. The farther away you are from your home state or homeland, for that matter, the more likely you are to not be retained.
Tom, thanks for that call. Go next to Rich on the line in Nina. Rich, hi.
Hello. I've got two kids that are about to go into college, and they're asking me, you know, what should we go for? And I'm like, with all the government regulations, limiting, what doctors can charge and all that, like, how can I recommend, them going into the medical field?
Rich, thanks for that call. And we hear that sometimes, regulations, worry about malpractice, lawsuits, things like that. Are people steering clear, George, of becoming doctors?
Well, that has been cropping up more and more as a rationale for not entering the medical field. I think, to a large extent, the reasons that folks enter the medical field is that they want to be caregivers. There are also those who seek, they're scientists and people who seek greater knowledge, and they tend to be those kinds of folks. So those who still want to provide care, who want to be caregivers, who want to help patients are the ones who tend to gravitate towards the medical field.
Rich, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We're talking to George Quinn. He's with the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce, looking at that organization's new report, looking at a potential shortage of doctors in Wisconsin in about 20 years. Still time for your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Are you in healthcare? Do you see this happening? Is this a slow-moving crisis? Do you train doctors? Are you in one of the medical schools here in the state? As a patient, do you worry about this? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll take another caller. We've got Nick on the line in Madison. Nick, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Nick?
So I'm actually a registered respiratory therapist. I have my bachelor's degree in respiratory science, and I have been closely watching the AARC website. For the creation of an APRT, which is an advanced practicing respiratory therapy position, which would put RTs on level with PAs and NPs, and it kind of in a way to help kind of get bridge the gap in the future shortcoming of physicians. I'm just kind of interested on what your guest has to say about something like that.
Nick, thanks for the call. So, George, something not more doctors, but maybe having certain kinds of specialists get more advanced training and licensing, presumably, is that potentially part of the solution?
I think it's both inevitable and necessary. We just will not be able to produce enough physicians to close the gap.
So what would we have to do to make something like that happen? Is that something the state would do to license? Is this a national medical issue? Who would have to take the lead on something like that?
Well, one of the issues has to do with licensure and broadening the current licensure capabilities of various practitioners. Secondly, in as much as there's a need to produce more physicians, there's also a need to graduate more nurses and nurse practitioners and other pharmacists who are also becoming part of a team-based care work group. And others, I think we need to be as flexible as we can, but at the same time, we need to understand that educational institutions, we need to admit more and graduate more of these other clinicians as well.
Thanks for the call, Nick. We'll go next to Marcy in West Allis. Marcy, hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. I was wondering if PAs are going to have to take on more of the responsibilities that doctors have, seeing as though we're going to have a shortage.
Marcy, thanks for the call. You'd mentioned physicians, assistants, and nurse practitioners. Are we going to have to have more of them doing more of the work that currently goes to doctors?
I think that's going to be the case. The pattern of that, the model that's used in any particular organization will differ. Each health system will take on its own approach to this team-based care model, a different mix, if you will, of practitioners. So whether it's PA or it's an NP or even, let's say, a pharmacist or other practitioners, it'll all be very unique to that particular health system.
Is this going to require a culture change that includes patients here? Because I imagine a lot of people come in and say, I want to talk to someone with MD after their name to talk about my problem.
I think that's also something that's going to have to be accommodated, and it'll have to change. I know I'm aware of that kind of attitude towards various initials behind certain people's names.
Let's go to another caller. Thanks for that. We'll go next to Jill on the line in Wausau. Jill, hi.
Hi, I have a son who just graduated from medical school, and what they're being told at, there are more students in medical school than in the history of the United States, but there's a shortage of residencies that hospitals, because they're not receiving federal funding, oftentimes are cutting their residency programs or just making them in, like you say, into family medicine or surgery or psychiatry. And the other one, he's in a residency right now. And when he accepted it, he wanted to go into dermatology. He's doing a transitional year, and that hospital has now dropped their dermatology residency.
Jill, thanks a lot for the call. So, George, a bottleneck not necessarily in the medical schools, but in the residency that you need. I don't fully understand how it works, but you need to do many specialties in medicine.
Well, again, residencies are the postgraduate training that's necessary, and various specialties require certain time frames for that. For example, family medicine requires 3 years, psychiatry 4 years, general surgery 5 years. One of the reasons, one of the impetuses behind our suggesting and implementing the state grant program was a recognition that these kinds of things are happening at the national level where we don't have as much control. In Wisconsin, we're able to control it a bit better by making these grants available, thereby providing incentives to health organizations, health systems, to start and expand their own programs.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jill. So, George, this is a slow-moving crisis, which in a way is good news. It gives us more time to do things, and it takes time to train more doctors. Is it harder, though, because we're talking 20 years off, to create a sense of, I guess, urgency among people who would need to be on board to solve this?
Well, that is part of the problem. It's also, you know, you make a projection 20 years in the future that has many assumptions attached to it, but it's really necessary for us to do that. It takes about 15 to 20 years to train a physician. When you include the undergraduate, the medical school, and the postgraduate training and residency programs, it's anywhere between 15 and 20 years. So we need to look at these issues today if we want to make changes.
And do you see all the necessary parties at the table taking this seriously and starting to make these moves?
Well, there have been a lot of organizations that have stepped up to the plate, both in terms of the state government, as well as health systems, as well as the medical schools and the professions. So there's a general recognition of a need to deal with this problem, and a lot of folks have become engaged in it.
From the level of state government, briefly as we wrap up, if there's one thing that the legislature and the governor could work on that would help with this problem, what would it be?
Well, it would definitely keep in place our existing program and even expand it, because as we indicated in the report, the efforts taken thus far have been terrific, but they will not be enough. So we'll need to redouble that effort.
George, thanks a lot for joining us here in the studio today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to George Quinn to talk about a potential doctor shortage here in Wisconsin. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Council on Medical Education and Workforce. His group released a report looking at this potential shortage we've been talking about and some ideas that can help address it. You can read that report, by the way, on our website, WPR.org. We've got a link to that also at the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.